Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
James has got a Posh new glass. Have you, James?
Oh, it's an odd one. You just probably haven't seen
I've never seen that one before, James. Don't do that.
It's nice. Sorry.
Gaslighting him.
This, my mum and my sister found these in a charity shop and correctly thought I'd like them.
Mm. Oh, so, they didn't nice find them in a sand dune and dig them up and bring them to you.
It's highly possible. That would explain a number of events in my life.
Yep.
The curse. Well, that's me. Anyway.
Britain. An ancient kingdom with legends of violence, cruelty, and torment in its blood. Join your hosts, Ross, John, and James, as they bravely tread where few would dare. Witness their journey into the horrific history of British horror. They are... The General Witchfinders.
Right, okay, ladies and gentlemen, goblins and ghouls, welcome back to the mindless twaddle, one-star review of the 43rd episode of the General Witchfinders podcast. I'm James in Bournemouth in southern England.
I'm John Pountney in South Wales, which is still in the South of Wales, and I can't believe that we've watched 43 films in 3 years.
Well, me and James have watched more because we've done extra ones as well.
God, it just makes your mind just...
Oh, we watched, in the first year, we watched 20 films.
No, we did.
We did.
Did we really?
In the first year, we watched 20 films. Then we watched one, but that was lockdown, wasn't it? Then we watched 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 films in the second year, and then 9 in the
Oh, my God, fathers.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair play. There we are.
All right, so, I'm sorry, and Ross, you haven't said who you are.
Oh, sorry, I'm Ross in Dorchester, and this time we woke up 28 days later.
Hello! Hello!
So who are you?
Wake up today in hospital, wake up and I'm hallucinating.
Hello! I've got some bad news.
Infected!
Father!
Infected with
blood!
Oh, I shouldn't have done that.
The blood. There's something in the blood.
Lesson one. You never go anywhere alone unless you've got no choice.
Hello?
Lesson two. You only travel during daylight. Unless you've got no choice.
This really is a bad idea. You know why? It's obviously a bad idea.
We have to leave now. More will be coming. They always do.
They're dead. And you're gonna be next.
So, 28 Days Later is a 2002 British post-apocalyptic horror film, our first film from the 21st century.
God, is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently so. Whoa. We have covered two other topics that were made in this century. What are they? Says Ross's script.
Can you remember?
No.
Okay, so...
Well, what's the question?
So, we've this is our first film from the 21st century, but we've done two other things which were made in this century so far. Can you think what they are?
A Mark Gatiss thing, probably.
Kind of.
Oh, go on then. What?
So we've done the Road radio adaptation, which was
And
we did Never Trust the Rabbit short story.
Oh, book. God. Yes, the book. Yeah.
So those are the
way ever... back in episode 4 or something, was it?
8. Episode 8.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So,
God,
yeah.
We'd already done 7 by then.
Yeah. But before, but this is the first film we've done from the 21st century.
Yes.
Wow. So it says that Ewan McGregor was the original choice to play the protagonist.
No way. Jim.
But he and director Danny Boyle had had a falling out at the time over the beach, in which McGregor had been slated to play the lead, but was then replaced by Leonardo DiCaprio. And of course, McGregor and Boyle have since reconciled because they made Trainspotting 2 together.
Trainspotting 2. T2.
T2. Not to be confused with Terminator 2, Judgment Day. The original.
Far superior film. And
absolutely far superior film. After McGregor, the role was offered to Ryan Gosling, who passed.
What?
Was it?
Yeah.
In 2002, he was two. About 10.
All these people are much older than you think. They're all like in their 50s and 60s.
Everyone's aging much better now. It's the diametric opposite to the 1950s
and 60s. Killian Murphy's 65.
Well,
he's right, older than Nigel Farage.
So Ryan Gosling, who passed, having a scheduling conflict, leading to the film being offered to the relatively unknown Killian Murphy. Peaky Blinders / Oppenheimer star Murphy unsuccessfully auditioned for the role of Batman for Batman Begins, of course. But Christopher
Killian
Nolan
Murphy is 47.
But Christopher Nolan liked his audition so much that he gave him a role as the Scarecrow, who appeared in all three Nolan Batman films. Murphy is also apparently a huge Doctor Who fan.
According to IMDb.
Says the Doctor Who fanboys. Skeptical of this.
Right. Proper Doctor Who or the modern rubbish?
It says, speaking of which, the film also features the ninth Doctor, Christopher Eccleston, with a very gingery, biscuity hue.
Yes.
Terrible posh accent.
Yeah. As well as Naomi, Miss Moneypenny Harris, Megan Burns, and the great, great Brendan Gleeson.
With a terrible accent as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was passable. Yeah.
He just should have been Irish because he just sounded
There's no reason for him not to be Irish.
Yeah, all right, mate. Yeah, come on in. Yeah, don't worry about the zombies, mate. We're getting my taxi.
But because
now.
He had that accent, I didn't recognise it was him. I was going, he's going to be in this later on.
The magic of acting.
Yeah. I thought it was Olivier all the way through.
So apparently, Brendan Gleeson, who according to IMDb is born on the same date as Councillor Deanna Troi herself. Mariana Curtis. Now, Danny Boyle's. Oh, hold on a second.
The pipes are calling.
So, Danny Boyle was the director. He's had a strange old filmography, Danny Boyle. Bearing in mind, he's a very. You would have to describe him as a successful filmmaker. Mm. When you actually look back, you're like, oh, God, I totally forgot he directed that. Mm. That film's had no cultural impact whatsoever, etc., etc. And bearing in mind that he directed a film that was just, resplendent with Oscars in Slumdog Millionaire, a film that you barely either see or hear about.
God,
No, I showed it to the kids the other day, and it was like, oh, I forgot there was so much paedophilia and drug abuse and stuff in this film.
Dog abuse?
Drug abuse, yeah.
I was like, oh. God, I thought paedophilia and dog abuse. Helen and I went to see one of his films, and it was absolutely awful, but it was remarkable just for the fact that at the time he was with Rosario Dawson.
Yes.
And she is totally full frontally nude in it about at least three times.
What film
is
that?
And you're just like,
is this
I can't
trance?
Remember.
Is this trance,
I honestly
from my
can't
film
remember. It must have been about 2012, 2013. And I remember thinking, because it was around the time of the Olympics, I do remember thinking, I wonder if the Queen has watched this and has been disgusted by this filth.
We are not amused by eyes to die.
Yeah. We walked out of it like, what the fuck was that meant to be? It was absolute garbage. Right. What else has he done, Jane?
Right, okay, so according to Ross's script here, so the big ones are Shallow Grave, which was his first feature, then Trainspotting, which is the thing for which he's most synonymous.
Defined our teenage years.
The 90s. Yes, I thought that was absolute shit.
Well, interestingly enough,
good soundtrack.
His follow-up film, which people were absolutely wetting themselves over after Trainspotting, A Life Less Ordinary, because people were like, oh, Danny Boyle's going to do a film with Hugh McGregor, and it's going to be absolutely wonderful. It was dreadful.
Mm. Went to see it with Simon, 1998. It was very bad.
It is very bad.
It's got a kind of weird matter of life and death kind of thing, hasn't it? With like people who are angels or in white clothes. And Yeah. All I remember, I've got to get this in before we do the review. I think, Cleves, that me and you went to see 28 Days Later with Simon.
All right, okay.
And Hell, and your other from back in the day, who remains nameless on this podcast. And I think we went to see it in Atlantic Wharf in Cardiff, down the bay. Right.
Yeah.
And we came out. We weren't fussed at the time, and Simon said he could have stayed in and watched Casualty.
Yeah.
And that was his review.
Is that so when we had an argument over who someone being in Independence Day? And
potentially, yeah. Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, and I said he wasn't in it, and you made me get money out of the cash point to pay you for the bet.
A bet's a bet, Cleves.
Good hustling, Joe. Well done, sir. Right. So it also says that he directed The Beach, of course, which is when he first worked with Alex Garland, who's the writer of this film. But then the science fiction / horror film Sunshine, which lots of people love.
And it left
me very cold when I watched it. I was really disappointed by
What's his name? Brian?
Brian.
Cox. Yeah, it was a scientific advisor on that film.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Always think of, whenever I think of that film, I think of Event Horizon.
Cut from the same cloth.
I figured episode 42 of Doctor Who.
Well, that was ripped off from Sunshine, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So.
And
with Michelle Collins, TV Cindy Beale.
Exactly, yeah.
Another EastEnders.
Yeah, but not the biggest wanker of them all.
Which was
another one star reviewing
TV's comic. Wendy Richards. Is it Wendy Richard or Wendy Richards?
I always
depends if there's more than one of them.
Really wish I'd say.
What year is this, madam? or it might actually be, madam, what year is this?
Can you say Cutty Sark in that voice?
Cutty Sark.
Madam, what year is this?
So he also directed the movie 127 Hours about the guy who got his arm stuck in the rock.
That was good. No one wants to watch that, do they?
Yeah, it was a good film, but you can't like anything with that guy now.
Yes, and also Ross hasn't put it in the script, but also on the other side of the equation, I've got to point out that he did direct the Steve Jobs movie.
Oh, I never watched it.
Which is pretty good, which is worth watching. Yeah, it's like a stage play more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And it's three times when Steve Jobs is about to go and give like the keynote speech at the Apple thing. Yeah. And it's at different times of his life.
Okay. Does he film all with Dutch angles on a digital camera?
I can't remember.
Which you can't see what the fuck's going on.
Bear in mind, we're giving Dutch him a bit of shoeing here. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed that one. Mm-hmm. However, I must also point out, he directed that dreadful movie Yesterday, where everyone forgets that the Beatles have existed.
Is that Danny Boyle?
Yes.
It's awful.
The song in which the guy who's the protagonist and Ed Sheeran have a song off.
Yeah. Oh.
I thought that was just the man that did 24, not 24 weddings and a funeral.
Richard Curtis wrote it. But Danny Boyle directed it, and that was the last thing he's directed.
He was meant to film that Bond film, wasn't he? But then they had
They had a big falling out.
Yeah.
It is Trance that I saw, James. Yes. Mm. 2013 psychological thriller.
Again,
a screenplay by Joe Ahern. Who's Joe Ahern? I know that name.
But, Adam and Joe. No.
No.
Joe Ahern. No, he wrote Ultraviolet, and he was a Doctor Who director.
I thought he was a Doctor Who.
He directed Dalek and another.
Oh, okay.
And Chris Eccleston said he would only come back and do the 50th anniversary if he let him direct it.
Yes, and they fired Russell T or something.
Yeah.
So it cost $20 million to make, and it made $24.3 million. Yeah. So that's a flop, isn't it?
No, I remember at the time people were saying this film is ridiculous.
Yes.
So once again, very small cultural capital. Sorry if you are listening to this. A millionaire.
How far have we got now talking about nothing before we get to the film? This is the best bit, isn't it? Yeah. No one listens to hear us talk about the actual film we're reviewing.
Well,
what were the names of the people that left those reviews?
I can't remember name. No. They're not written on little dolls with pins in them.
He doesn't wake up in the middle of the night shouting their names out.
There's lots of red bits of string attached to
I will find them.
Different photos of them.
Yeah.
Right. So, Also, it's worth pointing out that, of course, Danny Boyle directed he was the artistic director for the opening ceremony for the 2012 London Olympics.
Which was very good.
Best thing he's ever done.
Yeah. And interesting, almost like Britain from another time.
There's an amazing documentary about all the preparations and stuff, and it just looked it's insane. It was great.
How far we have fallen since that.
Exactly.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, because I was inevitably thinking about Danny Boyle and thinking about the Olympics and all of that, and I thought, do you remember at the time there was a Conservative MP who, in the midst of that ceremony, had tweeted more multicultural crap. And loads of people just absolutely tore into him going, absolutely, how dare you? This is brilliant. And this is representing Great Britain. And he was really shouted down.
Yeah.
And I was like, these days, he would be applauded. He'd go, look at him taking a stand against wokeness or something like that. And I was like, Jesus, that really was kind of like the last days of old Britain.
I loved it.
The 20s, before Brexit and so on and so forth. But anyway, back to it. The other thing that he did do, big tick in the good column, is Danny Boyle also directed Frankenstein on stage for the National Theatre with two Sherlock Holmeses in it, Benedict Cumberbatch and Johnny Lee Miller, and Ross has put that James was indeed lucky enough to see live.
Yeah, very jealous.
They did that thing where they would swap who would play Frankenstein and who would play the creature. Adam Frankenstein, fact fans. Adam Frankenstein, that's the name he gives himself. Yeah. So the night that I saw it, I was really pleased because the creature was Johnny Lee Miller, Cumberbatch was Frankenstein, which I think was probably the best.
They're on Amazon Prime, I think, and I've sort of skipped through just watching both of them to sort of compare their different performances. It was really interesting.
Yeah.
Yes, I would say that Cumberbatch. I would say that he's seen as being a stronger actor than Johnny Lee Miller. Is that true? Or
I would say.
Yes.
Yes.
Johnny, if you're listening.
Again, multi-millionaire Johnny Lee Miller. I'm sure they won't lose too much sleep over this. Over our little podcast, pre-podcast. But also, Ross's script points out that Boyle was offered but passed on directing the following films. Alien Resurrection, apparently, work on A Life Less Ordinary.
Yeah.
Fight Club, apparently, although he was busy with the beach, although that's the first time I've ever heard that, Ross. And apparently 8 Mile, as he was busy with 28 Days Later.
With Eminem, is that 8 Mile?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What a lot of people don't know as well is that he's related to TV Susan Boyle from The X Factor.
They're the same person, I believe.
And he's directed a lot of her videos. And not a lot of people know that.
No. Nice. Well, also, it says here that regular collaborator with Boyle, one of my, this is me, James, not Ross, one of my absolute favourites is Alex Garland, who wrote this film. And that man has got a filmography that includes Never Let Me Go, Dread, which is the Judge Dredd film, which even though it says he didn't direct it, he did direct
it. It's fantastic. Really good film.
Really good. The absolutely incredible Ex Machina, for which he received an Oscar nomination. Annihilation, one of my top 10 films of all time. I love it so much. He also wrote the fantastic TV series and underseen TV series, Devs, which if you've got Disney Plus, it's all on Disney Plus now. You can watch that at your leisure. That's amazing. And the absolutely bonkers, the fantastically bonkers movie, Men. And he has the... and he has the
now it makes sense
intriguing looking Civil War coming out
that looks good
I cannot wait to see
not about the English Civil War
unfortunately not another American Civil War
God Men was
out there.
Well, that would be a good review for this because it's definitely a horror film, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Well, we have to go through each transformation at the end in great detail.
So, Alex Garland has said that he took inspiration for 28 Days Later from George A. Romero's Living Dead film series. He mentions on the commentary the two bits that definitely inspired it, both in not the original, but as in Dawn and Day of the Dead inspired him. And John Wyndham's 1951 novel, Day of the Triffids, the notion of sort of like the quiet apocalypse and sort of England fallen silent.
And the rest and also what coming out of the hospital, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
TV's, what's the BBC? What's the guy in the BBC one called? Carry on. Yeah.
The crew filmed during early mornings and temporarily closed streets to capture recognizable and typically busy areas when they were deserted. For the scene in which Jim walks by the overturned double-decker bus, which was on Whitehall, less. The crew placed the bus on its side and moved it when the shot was finished, all within 20 minutes. They had asked permission to place the bus outside Downing Street, but Westminster City Council had refused. When they arrived at 4 a.m., no one was the council was around. They just went ahead and did it anyway.
Yeah, amazing.
And he says on the commentary, like post 9/11, he's like, there is no way they would let us do this now.
Well, 7/7 as well, the old bus thing. You know.
Exactly. Yeah.
These are the parts that really remind me of Rose, the first episode of Russell T. Davies's Doctor Who, because it's, I stood and watched them film segments on St. Mary's Street in Cardiff, which didn't make it into the episode, infamously.
Okay. Mm.
Because the director, Keith Boak, went a bit rogue, and then things were very dangerous. And there was a whole sequence with a bus, and there was a sofa flying through the air, which could have hurt extras. And watching this, it really reminded me of watching that being filmed, which obviously would have only been about 2 years after this, maybe. I think it was 2004. The other day, I was told about that aspect, and I was told about knowing someone that worked on Life Force.
Yeah.
Who created the mannequins for Life Force, all the different animatronics. I can't remember who I was having the conversation with. So it was someone who was telling me about Keith Boak directing Rose, who was never asked back to do any more Doctor Who. And then they were telling me, I'm sure it's the same person, the same conversation, was then telling me about the last thing that they did was to make the animatronics for Life Force, and then they changed career. Mm. And I was like, that's a hell of a way to bow out, because the animatronics are like the best thing.
Amazing,
in that film,
yeah.
Yeah, so those sequences in this film are really very similar to the Dutch angles and the kind of weird golden filter are very, very like the first, the Eccleston first season of Doctor Who, which is quite strange, I think.
I think it was just a very popular aesthetic at the time.
It looks very early noughties, doesn't it, now, this film? And it looks quite, there's dated, and there's also like, there's the bit where he walks along and all the phones, the payphones hanging down at the start.
Yeah.
That's the only bit really that you kind of like, this looks massively different to now. Otherwise, it looks quite now, but it all in the way it's made, it looks very dated now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which is quite weird. So back on Ross's scripts, and we've got, it says, one of the first mainstream films to be shot entirely digitally, as we just discussed, although not the final scene.
If
you actually watch it, it's not. It was a huge financial success, grossing more than $82.7 million worldwide on its modest budget of $8 million. It became one of the most profitable horror films of 2002. And also, something else that I've thought about in rewatching this, and this came out the same year as Dog Soldiers.
There was
something really in the water, as in military versus supernatural threat, wasn't there?
Mm-hmm.
And it says that producer Andrew McDonald had access to funding from the National Lottery and pitched it to Universal Pictures, who declined to support it. Budget constraints proved to be an issue, with Christopher Eccleston having to take an emergency pay cut during filming. McDonald announced to the crew that the production had run out of money and that filming ceased without a closing sequence being shot. He says on the commentary that the bit when they crash through the gates, that kind of freeze frame, he said that was going to be the end of the film.
Oh, really?
Oh, no way.
Yeah. For ages. He was like, we filmed it and then we showed it to Universal. He went, no, you can't stop there.
Yeah.
You need to do a coda, which is so different from every other film we've done on this podcast.
Yeah. The end.
No. Yeah. So, and then it says, after pitching several endings, the original, which featured Jim's death, and having watched it now on the aforementioned DVD, it's exactly the same, just with no Jim.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no way.
Okay, it's a chicken instead. She's talking to a chicken on the table. There's like a chicken on the table, and she's putting together like the flags.
Hello thing.
Why
would you spell hello when you could do help with three letters?
That's literally what I have said.
Right. So yes, but that original ending, which featured Jim's death, tested badly with audiences. The studios granted more funding to film the ending scene, which was eventually used and shot on film.
On film, right,
so it looks very, very different.
Well, that's
the crew organized for a real jet to fly overhead for them to film, as this was cheaper than the approximately £70,000 for a computer generated one.
That's mad, isn't
it? Which I could do now on my laptop whilst we're doing this.
For about two pence. Yeah. I remember interviewing the guy who directed Rogue One.
Mm.
And I can't remember his name now. Gareth.
Gareth Edwards.
Gareth Edwards. He's a lovely guy. I interviewed him for Welsh BAFTA about.
Cool.
Oh my God, so long ago. When Monsters came out.
Yeah, Monsters.
Yeah.
And I remember what really stuck in my mind was that all the stuff that was in Monsters, all the vehicles and stuff and planes and stuff were available online to download as like renders you could use in films and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that's mad that the difference between that, which Monsters was like 2008, and this is 2002. So that's only 5 years.
Mm. Yep.
It was cheaper to get a real jet plane.
Yep.
When you watch it now, I remember at the time thinking, that's a jet plane. When you watch it now, it's really obvious that it's not a contemporary jet plane. Mm-hmm. It looks like a 50s jet plane or something.
It looks like one of the ones from like Thunderball.
Or something like that. But that is kind of realistic though. If things all went to shit, you know, maybe they were
I don't know if they'd get a jet out of like Duxford Air Museum to go looking for people. But that's an interesting kind of thing at the end that you're like, oh, that jet looks really like anachronistic now.
Yes.
So should we start with the film?
We've got
one more.
Must be a record for the intro.
It is. But it says this film was then followed by the highly disappointing
Far Superior
sequel.
Oh, interesting. I prefer 20 weeks later. Yeah.
Oh my God, it's it like, far better.
Being really
for a start, it's got Imogen Poots, who is like the best looking film star of the 21st century. It's just a far better film, James.
Well,
isn't it?
I just don't like the whole point of this film for me, and the thing where like they could have run with it is the whole notion of Britain is under quarantine, and I love the notion of they would have just left us to get on with it. And so the notion that at the end, like you see them in Paris and stuff, I was like,
I didn't like that ending. Lot of the stuff I thought was
the
stronger.
The opening's good. I remember the
bit
opening
with Robert Carlyle running down the hill and stuff at the start.
That's good. Hell.
I had to watch that through my hat in the cinema because I was absolutely shitting it. And I just thought, I think that's a better film.
Interesting. Okay. And apparently Boyle and Garland have been, and apparently Cillian Murphy now with his Oscar nominee flex and power.
Are interested
in doing a third part entitled 28 Years Later. Years,
which it almost is now.
Yeah,
what do you think?
It is, right? Which makes you feel incredibly old.
And Ross has put, this may be released in three parts, depending on what rumours you read.
Yeah.
But I've read that it's a trilogy. I read that a couple of weeks ago I watched it, but when I knew we were watching it for the podcast, I then saw, by coincidence, they were talking about doing a trilogy now. Are there another three films to squeeze out?
I don't know.
Thing is, with content these days, people will literally watch anything these days, won't they? And you could probably make 48 films and people would still watch them.
They made several series of it. It was called The Walking Dead.
My God.
I did my homework, Ross, and Walking Dead, and I was going to ask you guys about, you know, your thoughts on this as regards, like, you know, there was obviously something in the water going on because The Walking Dead is a comic came out in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really?
And so, obviously, like, a revival of zombiness. Knowing how long it takes to make comics, I very much doubt Robert Kirkman would have seen this and gone, and now I want to do a zombie comic.
Yeah.
But I think that in the cultural milieu, as it were, there was obviously something going on.
But the kickoff is just so similar, though, isn't it? The whole accident and waking up in hospital, it feels like...
That's an archetypal disaster. That is literally exactly the start of the Triffids, John Wyndham novel. And then it's exactly the same in the BBC version with John Dateen, who I've just Googled. And later on, Gary Olson, who went on to be the father in 2.4 Children.
Four Children.
And then died very young.
He did.
So anyway, so big hello there to Gary Olson from Beyond the Grave. We thought you were great. I've lost my thread slightly. But,
keep pulling on.
That bloody Walking Dead was terrible. I watched a series where they were just on a farm, like the Waltons.
Mm. Oh, that's my favourite series, that one.
Oh, my God. And it was like, there's nothing happening. Yeah. There's no zombies. They're just on a farm. There's no fence. Like, how do they stop the zombies coming?
Yeah, that was, I don't know. That was my favourite series of it, but I think...
Terrible.
Yeah. It just went on and on and on and on and on.
Yeah. I'd want to be, like... we'll see now. But I think the best way to deal with it is to be in the top of a block of flats with a lot of doors and stairs between you and the zombies, and just go out in a car. Don't walk around and just have a load of machine guns.
I'll just go to Portland. That's where I'd go.
Well stocked cruise ship has always been my go-to. I'll get out of sea.
James Randall's autobiography coming soon.
Yeah.
A well-stocked cruise ship.
Would you wear a little captain's outfit, John?
You know I would. Yeah. I'd want to go for the white shorts and the quite high white socks.
Like Ron Hubbard.
Yes. Doctor at Sea.
LRH, yes.
Yeah. Well, right. At the Dorchester Museum, they got a brilliant like hall in there, and I think that would be my post-apocalyptic sort of like.
Oh, I've always thought about this, Joe.
court. I'd be like Q, where people yeah.
Come in on a floating chair.
Yeah.
Taunting Patrick Stewart. Right.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So how does the film start? Oh, it's the monkeys.
Right. Yes.
With TV's David Schneider.
Schneider. Yeah.
But remember him from a TV series called Up to Something, which was on Children's BBC in the late 80s, where, as I've read tonight, he appeared on with Shane Ritchie, amongst others. Wow. But I do remember a sketch from that or another programme where a Geordie man presented it with long hair, and David Schneider played a wrestler in that, in a wrestling ring, and that was really funny. And that was probably about 1989.
Mm-hmm.
And then he popped up in this film. And I do remember laughing to myself at the time, thinking, that's TV's David Schneider, who at that point was most famous for being Tony Hall or whatever his name is from I'm Alan Partridge, wasn't he, at that point?
Yeah.
And, of course, his sterling work on the Days Today.
Cheese at him. Yeah. Yes. When Alan Partridge waves his cheese at him.
Absolutely.
And says something like, give me a show, you shit.
Yeah, smell my cheese.
Smell my cheese.
Monkey tennis. All of that.
So, yeah, we're in a not very convincing lab somewhere with monkeys.
Cambridge,
they
told us.
Yeah. Very dark lab that doesn't look very scientific at all, with lots of monkeys.
Being forced to watch the news.
Yeah, a monkey being forced to watch the news, which looks like something from like a really shit Roger Waters video or something that would be projected before Roger Waters' The Wall. Not Pink Floyd's The Wall, just Roger Waters' The Wall. And it's not very convincing. And then some people, some well-meaning idiots break
animal
in
rights activists
to let the monkeys out. And then, of course, a woman gets bitten on the face by a monkey while David Schneider screams unconvincingly about them being infected or contagious or something.
Beck was saying, if they really were infected with that, there'd be guns and stuff around. So just in case if any of them did get out, you'd just shoot it.
You wouldn't be just be pressing on an intercom, would you?
No.
No, I put that it was a bad day for Arnold Schifter and the Peachy Chips.
Rated, Fred.
Here, Arnold, do you know I've gone into an uncontrollable killing rage? If you would hum it, I might start playing a few bars, etc. There's one for the teenagers.
Yes. Right.
What they needed was Bernard Cribbins to do a voiceover for all of those monkeys at that point.
We was getting nowhere, and so we had a captain.
Okay. I will be editing that scene with that music over the top of it.
Lovely.
Yeah, boy. It's basically Day of the Triffids then, isn't it? Mm-hmm. When he wakes up with his winky out.
Yeah, yes. Sorry for him.
I put well done, Cillian Murphy. Yeah. Because he's very naked. Yeah. He's not just naked for like, yeah. It's a quick flash. He's naked for a very long time.
My question for that scene is, would he be naked? Wouldn't you be in some kind of gown?
I don't know. Do they?
I think it...
That's what they're doing, but they was operating on his head, weren't they?
Yeah, but it's obviously post-op at that point. They haven't run off and left him there in the middle of an operation because his head's been sewn up. So why is he naked? Hmm. I just think that's careless on the part of the nursing staff.
Yeah.
I think it's just because it's such a very striking and unexpected image. Yeah.
It is a very striking image.
Maybe it's the same nurses from American World from London who we know check out people's genitalia when they're under.
I potentially don't know that because I think I probably skipped most of that film. And to be fair, I skipped quite a lot of this film.
Oh, dear.
We then get the very, very famous opening, and that's just disgust, as Cillian Murphy makes his way out of the abandoned hospital. And my notes are, hospital racing, John? After last time, saying about hospitals? Do you think this is an all right hospital?
It looks very modern.
It does.
But yeah, I mean... I was intrigued to see a Costa Coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I didn't know Costa Coffee's dated back so far, actually.
Yeah.
But probably with things like that, they were in London first and then they went to other places. Correct.
I can remember going to London. There's a really great restaurant in London called Subway. Like, whenever I go to London, I always get it.
I love an Italian BMT 6-inch with a honey mustard dressing and gherkins.
I have the Emperor wrap.
I bet you do.
Please listen, Subway. We are available for sponsorship. We are available. We will sell out very easily.
These bits are very effective, though, aren't they? Where he walks around the hospital and other bits of street. He walks across Westminster Bridge like the Daleks did in the Dalek invasion of Earth.
But there's a point where he finds a newspaper, doesn't read it. Would you fucking read the newspaper?
He just looks at it. The front cover.
Yeah.
We'll come to that in a second.
And it's a very bad, not legit typeface, which is spaced really horribly.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think the art department were asleep at the wheel at that point. And I would have had a fucking screaming abdags if I had directed this. And some lackey came to me with that front page of a newspaper. And I was like, that doesn't look like a fucking newspaper.
It's been printed
newspaper.
Off with Microsoft Word, hasn't it? Well, this
looks terrible.
But also, I didn't realise, as I was having watched it in the cinema when it first came out and having not seen it for a long time since, I forgot that it's got soundtrack over this.
Yes,
sequence.
Which is quite weird.
Okay, and I put it doesn't need it.
It would be more effective, just quiet.
Just silent.
There's the jump scare when he triggers the car alarm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's when the soundtrack goes off. Yeah. It's like, it would have worked with just...
But I don't know. Silence. Okay, if you was in that situation... I don't think I'd be out in the middle going, hello! Hello!
No, I wouldn't.
I think I'd be like, right, something's bad happened.
This is really fucking
I need to hide.
As we've just discussed, I put that he finds a very fake Evening Standard, which, as John says, looks awful. And by comparison, another film which has got some of the same kind of DNA to this movie, I think, which is A Quiet Place.
Mm.
Yes. When you see A Quiet Place, they do a similar-esque thing that you see that the dad has got all the, kind of like the news stories about the alien invasion up on his wall. They've got the New York Times, the Daily News from New York. And it's like, it just says, it sounds. And it's like, these aliens are responding to sound. And apparently, I thought this was really nice. They contacted him, whose name I entirely forget now. He was Jim in The Office.
Mm, okay. Yeah.
You know. Yeah. And they just said
Mackenzie Crook.
No.
But they got in contact with him just to say full permission to use the masthead, and for what it's worth, that's exactly the headline we would have used. Mm-hmm. If this
no
was
way,
real, that's what we would have done
good,
because it's short and it's punchy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So that's what made me think. I was like, wow. Whereas in A Quiet Place, they do a really good job of making you think that's the real newspaper headline. This
is terrible.
Oh my God, no,
but it's interesting.
It's like Times. It's like Times New Roman with loads of space around it, and you just
no
like,
pictures.
At least use the same typeface as the fucking paper would have used.
Yeah,
they wouldn't have used the serif typeface, you idiots. Mm.
So they have like a board with all the people like with the lost people, and they said this is pre 9/11, and they was like,
round the Eros sculpture in Piccadilly Circus.
Look very much like the shrine to Yonta Jones in Cardiff, doesn't it?
a little bit like that. What this makes me think is that we were lucky, really, to grow up in an era where history, and this is a chapter in the Andrew Marr book about the history of Britain, and since then, obviously, history has just gone mad again, where it says, really, that history has stopped, and history is just shopping now, and everyone's got loads of money, and everything's fine, and then suddenly... Mm. What happens in this, while they were filming this, is 9/11, which obviously precipitated a lot more history. And we're still living in the shadow of a lot of that mad stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, for the 90s, really, growing up, you know, on the news, you had like Yugoslavia and stuff, which was horrific. But you didn't have world wars. You didn't have plagues.
Yeah.
You didn't have... So, you know, we made films about stuff like that.
But my daughter asked me today, is the war in Ukraine still happening? I said, yeah, it is. She goes, it's not going to be World War III, is it, Daddy? And I was like, well, I hope not, you know.
No.
But whilst I'm listening to a podcast about Oswald Mosley, it's just, I don't know, stop talking to me. I'm listening to about fascists.
About Nazis.
wearing his black shirt. So I think that this film says a lot about a point in history where, like, if you think about what has happened to us,
there's a lot of stuff that happened in that film which actually happened since that.
But yes. But also since 2012, if you think of all the stuff, like we said earlier, if you think of all the stuff that's happened since the Olympics in 2012 to Britain, a lot of that is to do with foreign, you know, we've had people murdered on British soil by Russian agents. Mm. And no one did anything about it. They just let them get away with it. And then when they did an interview saying, oh, they'd come as tourists to look at Salisbury Cathedral, everyone just laughed about it. And I was like, these guys murdered someone. Mm. And it was just everything.
And shut down a whole city.
Yeah. And now, and things like that now were just laughed off, like, oh, the next thing in the news cycle. Mm. And it's just very, very weird. When you think back to this time, like the biggest news, you know, when you think about the 2010 election, when Gordon Brown called a bigoted woman bigoted woman, that, you know, that was a massive furore. Actually, what he did was right. And I think
the world has gone quite
mad. Yeah. The world has gone really mad. But when you look at films like this, it's people fictionalizing big happenings because they weren't really big things happening. Mm. And then obviously, while they were making this, obviously they had 9/11, which was a massive... You know,
and apparently this film became really popular during the pandemic as well. You know,
yes,
oh, did it.
Yeah, it's just we've lived through it.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah. He mentions Danny Boyle mentions on the commentary track. He says that he was inspired a lot by and like the notion of Britain being quarantined. That idea again. He said, "Oh, because he said we had a flare up of foot and mouth." And John, I suppose that was like the biggest thing.
Yeah, wasn't it? I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, and sort of mad cow disease.
I remember. Helen and I went out for the day and we couldn't drive down certain lanes in the Vale because of foot and mouth disease. And I remember thinking, this is really quite strange. And then, you know, the news footage was like loads of cows being burned, you know, the carcasses being burned and stuff. And that was like, oh, this is a big deal. Whereas now those things happen every other week.
Yeah.
And we're just like, oh, God, it's just never ending now.
Become acclimatized. Yes.
So the next bit that's really scary, or the first bit, so I was pondering, and I don't know if you two will agree, this is potentially the first properly scary film that we've watched for this podcast.
I don't know. I got scared by Ghostwatch. I did, honestly.
When we were 15.
No. When I watched it on my own.
There's creeping you out.
Yeah, but this is a proper modern horror film.
Because this really... It didn't this time, but I remember watching the scene in the church at the time, and that really put the willies up me. So what happens is he goes into a church. You've got the iconography of the crucifix there, but then what annoyed me slightly now is that you've got something on the wall that says something like
"The end is really fucking nigh."
Yeah,
I was about to mention this.
I thought that's like no one would fucking write that,
right? I've put hipster graffiti, John. That's my. And like you, I just thought, who would spend the time to put that? Ooh, the end is extremely fucking nigh, guys.
I think no one is going to take the time to do that, are they?
Exactly. Because, that was that watching it again, like first time I watched it when I was like 22, fine. Now, as a more older and cynical guy, I was
yes.
No one would bother doing that.
I thought the vision of seeing all the dead bodies, everyone went to the church and died.
That's just very evocative.
Or
dumps bodies off at the church.
You can't bury them.
This is supposed to be the best place for them.
So that really put the willies up me.
I think he said he saw that actually from footage from the Ebola virus, they recreated that for this. And it's also very similar to the End of Life Force as well, with all the bodies outside the...
And fun fact:
the cultural keystone that is Life Force.
The infected priest who he then runs into, I dressed up as him for the last time. I think I did fancy dress. There you go, guys. It would have been 2006.
Right.
It was when I was teacher training, and all the people in my teacher training course did a fancy dress party for Halloween. And I said, "Oh, I need something like cheapish to do, and you can get one of those long priest outfits pretty cheaply." Apply zombie makeup, look all kind of sweaty, bang, Bob's your uncle. I was very pleased with the app, but I think that was the last time I ever did fancy dress. I've dressed up as an ugly sister since then, and I dressed up as Amy Winehouse for a school performance as well.
That's a zombie version of her, obviously.
But not, here's now. but that was, I think, the last time I did a fancy dress by. Anyway, yes, so Jim is attacked by the zombie priest. And the hordes and the big selling point for this film is that the zombies ran. Thinking back to it, the whole deal was, they don't shuffle towards you anymore.
They're not really meant to be zombies in this film, are they? And I think they're just people who are infected.
But I still have to get it out of my mind that don't get near dead bodies. And they're like,
That
it's not the dead you've got to worry about, it's the infected.
Very good point.
But also, all these films, always, there's not enough people throwing up for the stench of dead bodies because you'd be like, especially when they go into a room and then they go, oh, there's a dead body in here. You would smell that for fucking miles.
Well, they do when they go and see Jim's parents. They do.
That was the most effective part of it for me.
Yes,
and we'll get there.
In our yard when I lived on Elm Street in Cardiff, there was a piece of salmon under. Under a piece of stone that had gone rotten in the yard. And the smell from a tiny piece of salmon went on for weeks and we couldn't find it. And we were putting bleach everywhere. So if there's dead bodies everywhere, it would absolutely just hum.
Yeah, London would.
So the church scene is very effective. And then he meets up with a guy that I think used to be in Emmerdale and Miss Moneypenny. Mm. And they are introduced to him and they're just like annoying knobs, aren't they? They don't show him any kind of like
compassion,
kindness or compassion. He's just woken up like after a month or something. And his whole world's changed. And they're just like, get in the shop and eat some Maltesers. And
a couple of quick things. I think number one, it's interesting that they introduce those guys and you think that one of them, this is going to be your triumvir, as it were. They do a very good job of making you think that Naomi Harris and the other guy are going to be the other two main characters.
Yes.
So when he's killed off, that's quite surprising. That's very effective. Psycho, like Janet Leigh in Psycho. Yeah, it works.
What happened to him after that, Cleves? Because I'm sure he was in Emmerdale for a bit. Do we know what his name was?
Let me have a look. He was in Emmerdale.
Emmerdale.
He was Luke McAllister.
Yeah.
In Emmerdale. Who's also the older Peter in the Chronicles of Narnia, Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe.
Oh. Ooh.
He was in Holby for 39 episodes.
Oh, no way. Right. Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
So I've never seen, I didn't watch that. So he's done more things, but
he's done
just stuff I haven't seen. Yeah.
Yeah. So while I should just point out a couple of other things from my notes at the time is that first of all, when he's running away from the zombie hordes when he's saved by Naomi Harris and the guy from Emmerdale, and what he's running away from, I noticed there was a poster up in the background for Spearmint Rhino.
Oh yeah,
which I was like, Spearmint Rhino was of the time. That's no more. That's gone. Also, as well, when he came out of the hospital, when he was coming out of the hospital, lovely tango machine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that made me very nostalgic.
Yeah.
It's definitely still going. A Pepsi sponsored film. This.
It absolutely was, yeah. Wasn't it? Yeah, definitely.
There's a few monologues that are a bit like feel a bit shoehorned in.
Mm.
That are basically about like how fragile society is.
Yes.
And that very always,
Alex Garland.
Yes, it always gives me the willies. But I thought in this film it was particularly preachy. Mm. And maybe it was down to the acting, which is quite iffy in places.
It was, yeah. Especially the young girl, which we see later on.
Oh, she's absolutely terrible, isn't she?
Yeah.
So there's a bit where they go to his house and they look for his parents. That's very affecting, isn't it?
Yeah, that was horrible. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. So they hide down in the now very cinematic Canary Wharf tube, which, hey, fellow Star Wars fans, that's also the location that the aforementioned Gareth Edwards used for the inside of the Scarif base in Rogue One.
Yep.
Oh, no way.
And you can So, you know, any film fans, Canary Wharf tube is where it's at these days. So we find out that they're hiding out in Canary Wharf tube, and we get Cillian Murphy gets filled in, as John was just saying. There's a couple of monologues. One explains what's happened over the last month. The other one, the guy from Emmerdale, basically says to him, "You know, we tried to get out of the country," and tells this quite sort of terrifying. As to how he lost his family and the whole. I didn't know who the infected were and who was just fighting to survive.
Yeah, but he's talking about like he realised the ground was soft and he realised he was walking on people. I thought that was very effective.
And they then say to him, "Look, he says, "Look, I have to go and try and find my parents," and they just say, "Look, forget it." And they say, "Look, anyone," and I thought the line that was quite good was he says, "Anyone who goes doesn't come back." Mm. And you know, if you get caught, you're done for. So I thought that was all pretty good. But he says he's absolutely sort of hell bent, and they agree that they're going to go with him. He goes to, once again, one of the touchstones of this podcast. Last scene on the Quatermass, the one experiment. When he comes back from space. Yeah, Quatermass experiment. Deptford!
No. Deptford!
That Jim's parents live in Deptford. Way! Yes. South London for the win. So we turn up, Deptford, and as John says, when he turns up, we find out that, said a very affecting scene, we find out that Jim's parents have committed suicide. They say to him, "Look, at least they went out calmly, nicely.
Yes.
You know, they've not been torn apart or anything like this."
Yeah,
Jim
is, and they
kind of leave him a note saying, "You were asleep. Please don't wake up.
Please don't
wake up. The world's gone to shit."
Mm.
And then
see a bit of where the money's spent there, don't you? Because there's two quite good dead corpse models.
Mm. Mm. Absolutely,
they're not actors looking dead. They're kind of. I don't know what you call them, mannequins or life figures.
Dummies.
So that's where, because I did think £8 million for this film. Like, where did they spend the money? Until you get to the bit with Christopher Eccleston in it, doesn't look very expensive. Does
no,
it?
Not at all.
Yeah, I think money just goes really quickly when you're making a film.
It does, but it's one man wandering around. You know, it's not like 300 extras or 100 wildebeest, you know, majestically across the plain, is it?
No.
So that's very effective, and that's a very good scene, and that's a well-written scene. I think with any film like this, you can expect to see a few scenes like that where they kind of write themselves, and they're very effective because everyone can identify with that sentiment. Unfortunately, I think this film runs out of those
bits
quite quickly.
Well, we'll get to it, but as soon as they get to the soldiers, it changes what the film is.
It's just a load of shit.
Yeah, but I've had a dream before. I've had a dream before where something bad's happened. I don't know what it is, but I'm away from the family. Mm. And it's one of those things. It's like, do I stay where I am so that they know where I am and they come to me? Or do I go to them? And it's that whole kind of like, will I try and get to my parents or do I say, you stay?
Yes.
I think it was something like the communications all went down. Everyone's phone stopped working. What do I do at that point?
Yeah. My dreams like that are either floods. I look out of a window and I see an oncoming flood, which is horrific and just horrible. Or mushroom clouds, because I'm an 80s child.
Yeah.
I had a mushroom cloud dream literally about 2 nights ago.
Yeah.
And it's like, fuck, it's 2024. Threads
and T2 has done that to me.
Oh, my God. Yeah, horrendous. So there's a bit where they're asleep then in that house.
Mm.
And I've written, I wouldn't go to sleep ever.
I want to sleep in this house which stinks of my putrefying parents.
Yeah. And then he's wandering around and we see like a projection or something. But is it memories that he's having?
I felt that was totally unnecessary, that bit. 100%.
Yeah, but you don't need to say, okay, you need to know what it's like to have a parent so you can know. It's like, so you can feel that his loss. No, you get it, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
And
at that point, you're just thinking, because they're saying there's no power, there's no nothing. But then it looks like he's like knocked on the VCR or something, or like the Super 8 projector. And it's like, that doesn't really work very well. And I watched it a couple of times thinking, have I missed something? Or
But he does have a light out there, doesn't he? I think is that what attracts the neighbours?
Well, weirdly enough, later on we find out, and they say on the commentary, it's sound.
All right.
Again, it's supposed to be that apparently they hear sounds and it's sounds that they respond to. Oh, okay. Quite Ross.
Right.
Quite right, Ross. That it does seem to be light in this case. Because as I said, he's sort of snapped out of his reverie by the two of the neighbors. One comes through the back window, which is fine. And the other one comes down through like the skylight. And it's like,
yes.
What? Why would they climb up on the roof?
Weird. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just both run in. One of them wouldn't think, I'm going to climb up there and jump through a skylight.
At the exact same time.
But we did a big jump, like from his own garden and like go through that. But then,
that's quite a good jump scare, isn't it? Yeah, and then the guy from Emmerdale has a wound in his arm.
Yes.
And he's like, oh my God, don't do it. And then Miss Moneypenny hacks him to death.
With a massive machete.
And you're like, oh, this is quite a good kind of...
But if you can get infected by the smallest drop of blood going in your heart,
here we go.
You wouldn't have a hacking weapon, would you?
No. As we see later in the film, you can get infected by one drop of blood going in your eye. So at this point, they're covered in blood, aren't they?
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
All in their mouths.
There's quite a few sequences where there's just blood all over them.
Yes. Exactly, John. There's two things at play here. Number one is that it's quite clear that they never really thought out the rules for how infection was going to work at all.
Yes.
And to that end, it's then all over the show for the rest of the film. As you said, one drop does for poor old Brendan Gleeson.
Yes.
But then, as John says, all the way through the rest of the film, there's points when there's blood splatter everywhere.
Well, the soldiers are blowing up people. Exactly. Bits of body are just falling all over them.
And they're all laughing.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, guys, you've been covered in
Yeah, well, now we've gone through the pandemic, we'd all have our face masks on, wouldn't we? Yeah, we'd all have our gloves on.
She says at that point, have you been bitten? Which is more zombie kind of lore, isn't it? But I do think that this bit is silly. If you've seen the film already, which we all obviously have, because you're just like, for fuck's sake, later on, like, it's nonsensical. So anyway, we lose one of our leads.
Yes.
In the kind of psycho fashion of Janet Leigh is gone in the first reel. So that's a bit of a surprise. And then and the next shot then really reminded me of With Nell and I. Because it's kind of like a London skyline, which is like Trellick Tower or something.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, it's like, it's a bit like the bit where they drive in the Mark II Jag to the cottage. And
Scrubbers!
Yeah. And at this point, I just think,
accident, black spot, accident, these aren't accidents. They're throwing themselves
into the road, willingly.
Throw yourself into the road, darling.
So at this point, I've said, why don't they just travel in a car?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
They're walking through all these different bits of London.
Railway lines and stuff.
Why would you walk somewhere when you know all these fucking loonies are around that are just going to run out at any point?
And those lines might still be electrified. So don't walk on the railway lines.
And then do they see, is this the bit then when they see the light in the tower?
Yeah, see the lights in the tower, yeah.
So I have read something and I can't remember what it is, but that is lifted from something else where it might be a book I read in school where all old people die.
Empty World by John Christopher?
I can't remember. And two kids go to a tower like that. And they find out it's a recording and the person that was either flashing the light or doing the recording is already dead. And that's it. And that's a very, there's always a trope like that in these films, isn't there? Where you finally get to the place, when you get there, the person is already dead. And that's very much like survivors, Terry Nation survivors are all, you know, So they get to this tower, and then Brendan Gleeson's there with his awful accent and his terrible daughter.
Wait. A couple of things before we just get to that. They're in the tower and they are pursued by the zombies, even though they're not zombies, or the infected, whatever you want to say.
And the lift is broken as usual.
Of course. Brendan Gleeson does a really good job. You know, he has thought this all through.
Yes.
He's wearing full riot gear, a riot shield to stop.
Which you never see again.
Such as that.
No.
But I did point that, like, as they're running up the stairs, I'm sorry, Danny Boyle, it's dreadfully shot.
Oh, yeah.
The whole film is dreadfully shot.
And it's just how he shoots stuff. When I watched Slumdog Millionaire, it's just.
Handheld.
It's all handheld. It's all like.
Yeah.
It's all Dutch shot from Dutch angles from the floor looking up.
When
people move, the camera moves with them. And it's just. I know it's trying to get this. It's trying to get a bit of.
Dynamism.
Yeah, kinetic energy going on there. But there's points in it when you're going, I don't even know what you're showing me at this point.
No.
And it makes me feel like when we tried to make a short film as art students, we'd try and put the camera in the weirdest place we possibly could the whole time.
Yeah.
And it's just like, just shoot it. Yeah, I know we were talking the other day about like having boring camera setups nowadays compared to the 70s, but we still need to see what's actually happening.
Yes.
You know, otherwise, what's the point of setting it up?
That bit doesn't make any sense at all until they get to the top of the stairs. Brendan Gleeson is there with his riot shield.
But also, how many flights up do you reckon they went?
Loads.
Considering
as many as in Ghostbusters when they try and get to the top of Azul, the building.
Yeah, well,
Azulin.
So he hasn't eaten anything for 28 minutes. Apart from some Maltesers, and he managed to run up to the top of those stairs.
Yes. He does start to say that he's getting knackered.
This should really be the end of the film because they should go into that flat and be like, okay, we're just going to stay here because these people are nice. We can go and get food.
But I think they kind of imply there's no water.
That is the big thing.
So
we can get through this bit pretty speedily. Mm. In short, so we meet Brendan Gleeson and his daughter. The mother is dead. They are the only survivors left in this block of flats. And as we've seen, there has been, even though it's rainy old England, there hasn't been any rain for like 15 days or something like that. And the pretty good shot, isn't it, of all the buckets on the roof.
That's an iconic shot, but a block of flats like that would have a massive water tank in it somewhere.
Yes.
Legion
and it would be, but it would be gravity fed.
Mm-hmm.
It would be at the top of the building, I'm sure. You'd turn on the tap and then you'd just boil the water somehow.
Yeah, also there's Peckham Spring nearby, isn't there?
It's not like London is lacking in water.
Mm-hmm.
They then also hear that there is this recurring radio.
Oh, yes, he's got a wind-up radio, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Saying
Trevor Bayliss
saying that there is a cure or salvation is here and it's like it's close to Manchester and they decide, look, well, we've got to go for it.
Yeah.
So they decide flexibly that they're going to go for it. They get through the Blackwall Tunnel, makes an appearance, London fans.
Yeah. That's a much bigger sequence in my mind. My memory of that was much more scary and intense.
That could have been a really good sequence and it's not as good as it could be. And when they cut away from it at the end, you can tell that the people running after them are just extras who are knackered at that point.
And they all just start ambling.
And they're like,
amble along.
How did he drive a London taxi cab over the top of other cars?
It's really
with no ramp.
You just wouldn't do it, would you?
In this movie, a London cab has supernatural powers.
Yes.
But so they get through that. They then get the first salute to the Romero zombie movies because they go and stock up in a supermarket and that's Dawn of the Dead.
What's the music?
Where all the lights are on.
Granddaddy.
But I have written in that point, why are all the lights on in the supermarket? It's fully lit. And supermarkets without lights on are probably really dark places because they've only got windows at one end usually, haven't they?
That reminds me of a computer game where I had to go into a supermarket in the dark. I can't remember which one it was. And it wasn't the Jimmy Savile supermarket computer game.
What are you talking about? Have you had a stroke?
Someone asked Jimmy Fix It to design a computer game and they made a Jimmy Savile computer game for the Spectrum where it was Jimmy Savile doing a like a trolley sweep. Dash. Yeah.
Wow.
And it's got a picture of him on the front, like pushing the trolley.
This that, feels like this is a fever dream, Ross. Okay. I don't think this really
Yeah, happened. That would be in the show notes,
yes.
Dear listener. I've put at this point, why did they pick a knackered old taxi? Why didn't
He's
they
a taxi
pick
driver.
A nice... Oh, right. But then you could have just picked a nice, solid car, not something that sounded like it was going to break down at any minute. There's infection dialogue. So basically they get to... They do a couple of things, don't they, where they're character building. They go to the supermarket. Then they park up by some ruins somewhere and they have a bit of character building. And then they basically end up at the roadblock, which is meant to be on the M6 somewhere. They get out and they have a wander around. And then Brendan Gleeson is annoyed because there's no one there. Mm. And then he kicks a door or something. And then, as is aforementioned, he gets a drip of blood in his eye and he goes loopy and he's got the rage and he's like, get away from me. And then
some soldiers shoot him.
And then soldiers pop up and shoot him. And you're like, oh, okay. And this is where the film loses its...
At this moment, you guys may be interested to hear that on the DVD, they said that this isn't, from that point on, from Brendan Gleeson getting infected onwards, that is not the original script.
Oh, okay.
Oh, interesting.
And I will very happily now provide you with the précis of what happens.
Please do, James.
Thank you. There's no soldiers in it whatsoever.
Oh.
That's a second draft later edition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brendan Gleeson gets infected. Jim can't kill him and refuses to kill him. They manage to subdue him and put a bag over his head. and he's sort of writhing around. They say, look, they must have been protecting whatever the secret was, whatever the cure was, it must be here. And they're at the animal lab from the opening sequence.
Right.
They go in there and they have a look around. Oh, chaos, all the rest of it. David Schneider's there. And they decide that they're going to hole up there. Later on that evening, they hear some movement about and they go down into the basement, only to find that there is a scientist still alive behind a locked door. And this guy says, like, don't even tell me your names. Everyone. And they're like, where are the soldiers? And he's like, they're all dead. They're dead. Everyone's dead. You're going to be dead soon. They're like, and he's like, I haven't got any food to share with you. And, you know, just get away from me. And they're like, we've got food. We, you know, we want to help. We want to help.
Sounds like a nice guy.
Yeah. Well, and his whole thing is, you know, he's just locked away. And he's just like, I'm just going to sit here and read my book, he says. And then Jim, just the other two carry on. And we see that Miss Moneypenny is like doing rifle practice and getting really, really good with a sniper rifle.
Yeah.
And then intercuts with Jim talking to him through the door, basically saying, look, if you like it or not, I'm going to tell you all about my life. And then apparently it was like intercuts of him going, and then when I was at school, and then, oh, then my first girlfriend, things such as that.
Yeah.
The scientist buckles and then says, look, I will tell you what the cure is or what the salvation is, but it's difficult. It's problematic. You can do a full, you can cure a person if you give them a full blood transfusion.
No.
That's how you can get the disease out of them. They then start to get attacked by various zombies, and they say, like, on the storyboards, oh, they're, you know, that's what, like, the zombie attack. And they, so there was a sequence of fending off the zombie attack. They then find, when they wake up in the morning, they find out that the scientist has come out and left them loads of transfusion gear. Or there's a sequence where he comes out and leaves it in the middle of the night and basically says, good luck. If you want to do it,
I think the scientist is played by Peter Capaldi.
Very possibly. Like in World War Z.
Exactly.
World War Z. Yeah. And then Jim says, do it. We find out that he's got compatible blood with Brendan Gleeson.
Okay.
And he says, do the transfusion, do it. As more zombies are attacking them, they do the transfusion. Success. Brendan Gleeson is cured. And the film ends with the scientist opening the door to Brendan Gleeson, the daughter, and Miss Moneypenny, Naomi Harris. He then locks the door, and the final shot of the film is Jim, now with the infected blood, watching all the news on TV going, we've come full circle.
Much better.
That's much better.
There you go, everybody.
Yeah.
But then, do you know what they said the problem was? They said, oh, shit. The whole, and as we were just talking about earlier with the blood splatter thing, they were like, a full blood transfusion. It's like if you've established that one drop of blood can turn someone, you would literally have to hollow a person out.
Yeah.
And they were like, it doesn't work. So they totally painted themselves into a corner.
You could have just completely diluted it out. Yeah.
Or whatever, but still, you could see how they were like, this doesn't work.
Mm.
So then bringing the army, and you guys, I think you guys have already said it, that for me is what then watching it again now, all these years later, is what doesn't work. It feels like you've got this quite well worked out first two thirds of a film.
Works
and then
really
this
well.
Final third just feels like, we've got to do something at
it
the
does
end.
Feel like, it does feel like if this was a TV series, there would just be an episode where they meet the soldiers.
Yes.
They would go through all that, kill the soldiers, and they'd move on or get away from the soldiers. Or like the soldiers would be like a recurring enemy, which would keep coming back.
Yes. It's... straight away, I just question, are they even real? Are they even meant to be real soldiers?
That's the last people. If I was in a situation where this was happening, the last people I would be hanging around with would be a load of young men, especially if I had my daughters with me.
Do you know what? That is the one good thing about it, is that the dinner party scene, in inverted commas, which Danny Boyle says he was inspired by Apocalypse Now, when they find that sort of French...
Not the end of Carry On at the Khyber.
Maybe that too. But there is a really weird vibe. And when you're watching it, you're like, you would just want to get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
I thought, he does do a good job of making it like, all these people are arseholes.
Yes.
You don't want to be near any of them. And it doesn't, they're all just
in some ways, yes, but it's such a chasmic, if that's a word, chasmic change from the rest of the film in tone and feel. You also now see where they spent some of the money, but also it still looks really flimsy because there's only about 9 soldiers.
Yes.
So it just looks like they're in this house. It's not lit very well. Mm. And the lightning at the end just looks like someone's flashing a light through a window at them. Mm. And it just starts to become really unconvincing. Mm. Christopher Eccleston is introduced. His accent is terrible.
Do you think it's because we know what he sounds like?
But he's also not convincing in a posh voice. It's just he just doesn't come across convincing at all. And then
he does come across as an absolute creep. And when he's like touching their heads and stuff, you'd be like, I'm not staying here. I wouldn't assume.
No. So I said the army bit is bunk, expensive but shit, and that really for me sums it up. And what it becomes at this point is the monster is us kind of nonsense, which always annoys me in films like this because that I think that's quite lazy now that it's like, there's nothing worse than human nature.
Who's and, got rage, really? Yeah,
you're running away from the monsters, but then the monsters are actually us.
You.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't really
make it very clear at this point. If there's any kind of army structure there, if they're actually even real soldiers, if they're just people dressed up as, you know, it's just, and there's potentially something more interesting in that, but they don't go there because we're already like two thirds of the way through the film, aren't we?
Yep.
Then there's a bit where Cillian Murphy's taken off to be killed.
Refused to join in with their plot because you find out that there is no cure in this version of the story, that he's just trying to attract women there for the men. Because he says to rebuild society.
Yes.
Of course, there's horrible rapey overtones to it all.
There is, but this is also really unconvincing. Like, literally 4 weeks after society is broken down.
And also, they wait around for ages to do it. It's like, well, if you're going to do it, just do it now. You don't need to... It's a case of, like, why? What are they waiting for? Like I want them to do it, but it's just a case of, like... It's just this whole you know, like, they brought women here in order to have sex with them, but then I go, okay, now you need to get dressed up. Now you need to wait till this person comes back. And it's like, right.
Yeah, it's a horrible threat, but I think it's just really badly thought through. And then there's a bit where, Cillian Murphy and another soldier man is taken off
the
to
nice
this place.
One.
Yeah, yeah.
The nice one. Where all the, but there's loads of dead bodies already.
It's where they've been clearing the bodies off the ground, where they've been, because they've got that thing where they shoot them and blow them up.
I thought that was people that they had already killed and they put
maybe
there.
Some of that too.
So I at this point, I was just like, I have no idea what's going on. So the other nice soldier man is shot by accident. Cillian Murphy runs off. He sees a plane.
Thus establishing that the world has not ended.
And then from there on, I think the film goes really quite
Yes.
I've got to say though, I'd written the script before I watched it, and when I saw that plane flying over then, I said, they spent that money on that. Like,
a 737 going to Lanzarote or something.
Yes, Danny Boyle in the film just says he just filmed it in his back garden, Ross. He just waited and shot one going overhead.
So then at that point, it becomes a bit like Predator, where Cillian Murphy strips off and becomes like
a killing machine.
Arnie, yeah.
Yes.
But is are you meant to think he might be infected at this point? Because at the end, it's almost like it's meant to be like a reveal that he's not been infected.
No.
Or was it the fact that the characters in the film think he might be infected?
It would have been more effective if you did think he was infected, but at no point did I think he was infected.
Right.
No.
So I wasn't sure what I was meant to think.
No, and it's just not put across very.
But he has managed to take out supposedly like 5 or 6 fully trained soldiers. Yes,
yeah.
With weapons, and he's got nothing.
Yes. Right,
and he's a bicycle courier
From Deptford. I've got a couple of things here. First of all, the sergeant who they kill off, again, as Ross was saying, like if this was a TV series, he would be. It's like number one, he's too nice to be with those guys, and they kind of rush that through very quickly. But also, he gets two of the best kind of Alex Garland-y bits, which is number one. He is the guy that suggests, "Look, we've been quarantined. That's what they've done to us. We're the quarantine island," and it's like, "Oh, that's a really interesting idea." And then later on, when Eccleston goes, "We'll get everything back to normal," and he goes, "Maybe this is normal. Human beings have only been around for a little while, and us being wiped out—that's nature resetting. We're going back." That's a great idea. But again, it's like, that idea's done now.
Yeah.
So the two best ideas for me, he gets them, the nice soldier. He gets them both. They're disposed with really, really quickly. And then they go, he must be killed. because he's too nice. I was like,
both of those bits, James, because I fast forward all of that exposition. Because
okay.
the dialogue in this film, there's something about it that means it comes across as really quite stilted and quite dry and boring.
Yeah, it feels like people acting.
And I think that's what Simon might have meant by when we came out of the cinema back in 2002. He could have stayed in and watched Casualty. There are aspects of this where you do think of the acting is on a bit soapy and a bit stilted.
Mm, mm-hmm.
The daughter of Brendan Gleeson, particularly, is hopeless.
Mm. Yeah,
A lot of the soldiers are hopeless.
Mm.
Their Cockney accents are just like Dick Van Dyke, kind of identical. Like, why are all soldiers from London?
Yeah.
Or Cockney kind of, what the fuck are you going to do now, mate? And it's like, oh, for fuck's sake, this is terrible. Yeah.
And yes, and then, John, as you said, what doesn't really chime is, number one, they're going for the whole, Cillian Murphy, is he infected? And, look, is he as bad as those people? But also, as you said, he is someone who's a bike courier. And yes, you can say, look, when people are under duress and he really wants to save Naomi Harris and the girl, but what he does is just bonkers. He's never fired a weapon before in his life.
No.
And he storms back in, grabs a rifle and fires like really precise bullets to let the one zombie off the chain.
Off the chain.
That's the worst plan.
Yes.
Naomi Harris and the girl are still in the house.
Yeah.
They'll be fine.
Getting them all infected.
They'll be fine.
It's not a plan at all.
And then
it?
As the zombie is like running through and taking out the other soldiers, it keeps cutting to Cillian Murphy, like looking in, going like, he's really pleased. He's like,
yes.
Yes, and that's a
none
really
of it makes
odd choice.
Any sense at all.
And I think that was very, very strange. And then the really horrible soldier, he obviously gets his comeuppance last before this Eccleston, and he has his eyes put in.
Oh yeah, that was
which
good.
Is nasty.
Yeah. Which
yeah,
is,
yeah, and again, the whole is like, oh, has he gone ragey? Was it just humanity's anger?
For and me, then, that scene is totally at odds to the entire rest of the film. Because it's so needlessly gruesome and horrible. Because then he gets up, she realizes that he's fine, and then they have a big snog. And it's like,
again, kissing all the blood all over his face.
Yeah. They're covered in blood.
Yeah.
And it's like, would you kiss someone who's just gouged someone's eyes out? Yeah, they might be a twat, but you've just watched someone be killed by having their thumbs put through their
eyes.
Yeah.
Do you find
Got
that erotic?
Horny. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just like, this is fucking mental.
And bearing in mind, that's the whole build-up. We haven't mentioned it so far, but earlier, Naomi Harris had gone, you know, I'm a survivor, and that's how I've I kept going. And I, if I see someone who I think they've turned, I won't hesitate for a second to kill them.
But she,
and the whole point is she does hesitate for a second. That's proving that, oh, you know, maybe she loves Cillian Murphy and all the rest of it. But yeah, watching it again, like at the time in the cinema when I was a younger, the Bronte to zombie interface. Like, watching it as a more callow youth, I remember like, ooh. But now watching it, I was like, it's really contrived.
Yeah. It's horrible. It's
and really how they kill Chris Ferguson is also, like, the girl managed, she, the girl
reverses the taxi
into a bit, which just so happens a zombie is standing there, smashes the window, pulls him out through the back. But you don't see him kill, just in case you want to bring him back for
like, is that true?
a later film and stuff like that.
No, I don't think they thought about it. But I found it a bit like, I think she could have just... I don't know what, but still, you know, having established again earlier that she could drive the taxi, that was like the Chekhov's gun there, wasn't it? And then, as previously mentioned, they then break out from the military base. The original cut of the film he gets shot, but then we get this nice kind of echo of the start where he then wakes up 28 days later and, they're up in Scotland. Yeah. And we get the... quite famous now. I said, we were talking about it at the start, shot on film. They flag down the plane, thus suggesting that, yes, society has survived. And, and that the soldier was right. We have just been quarantined as an island and rescue is coming.
Yeah.
Well, I think the implication is that they just wait for all the mad people to starve to death, isn't it?
Yes.
And well, you see that on the road, don't you?
Yeah. But there are inherent problems with that, but it's also quite nice stylistically that you do notice the jump to film, which kind of makes a stylistic difference between the point where everyone's infected to the point where people aren't infected anymore. But then, as we've said, it's you see the word hell written on the floor, which later on turns to hello. But as Cleaver and I have written, and maybe James as well, wouldn't you just write help?
Or SOS.
Or SOS.
SOS would be the
or just like a big X.
A big X, yeah. You wouldn't necessarily write up, you know, hell as a thing, you know, works well in the film. I think that that would have worked really well as a kind of prologue where you just see hell and that scene kind of...
And then you come back to a flashback.
I think that would have worked a lot better than David Schneider. That's a weird film.
One of the things you said, John, is that it's not as scary as you remember. And I was the same. I can remember thinking, like, this is a scary film.
Well,
I remember the tunnel being scary.
Because there's no jumps. The little kid jumping out.
The kid scene. That was good.
That scared the shit. Because it's silent. Good. It was silent when he came out.
Yes.
That was good.
I mean, there are scary points in it. And I do think it's probably the scariest film that we've watched for the podcast because a lot of the stuff was made in 1972 and is like a lovely cuddle from old friends.
Yeah.
You know, even something like Deathline, which in itself is a really macabre and grotesque film, because it's nostalgic, it's kind of...
It's nostalgic divorced. Spade through someone's head.
Yeah.
It's like broom.
Yeah. Whereas this film... There is something unremittingly grim about it. And I when it finished, I felt really depressed and just like, oh, because it is like, even though it's finished on a kind of high note, you just think, fuck, that is a miserable film.
It's interesting, John, because on the commentary, Danny Boyle says, oh, people said the ending, because, you know, Jim was supposed to die originally. Did Hollywood lean on you? Did the studios lean on you to give it a happier ending? And he just said no. And he says, to be perfectly honest, when I watched it cut and all put together, I thought this is a really dark and draining film, and people need something upbeat at the end.
That ending is very upbeat because it's just like
they make
you don't see normality return, do you? You just see like,
and also I think that we've gone through, like we said, a lot of stuff which this film sort of skirts around. And it actually comes a little bit closer to home, maybe.
Well, yeah, you don't run, we haven't been running away from screaming abdabs, but Helen and I went for a walk yesterday and we went up to on the hill behind the house and I recalled in lockdown when I was up there on my own and I looked across and I could see four people who'd obviously come out of their house to meet in the depths of lockdown. And it was four people stood really far apart, all with masks on.
Mm.
And I did remember that point of lockdown and the start of COVID when everyone was like, no one knew what the fuck was happening. Mm. And I was washed. I was like disinfecting shopping.
Yeah.
From Co-op.
Yeah.
Like washing packs of bacon in fucking bleach and stuff. Cause we were like, no one knew how it was transmitted at that point.
I can remember like going into town and like outside the bank, there were chairs 4 meters apart down the road. So in order to go into that, you'd have to sit on this chair and then you'd have to disinfect it after you sat on it.
Yeah.
And it just felt like,
I was thinking
similar thing in B&Q.
Yeah.
And really I just remember how weird it was that we all had to queue to go into supermarkets and they'd only let so many of you in there at a time.
Yeah.
And I remember the day we was allowed to go to B&Q, I drove to the one in Poole just because I wanted to go for a drive.
Yeah.
And there were some people on motorbikes just going like 150 miles an hour just down the dual carriageway. Because there was no cars there. And then police cars like coming down and just chasing them off. But it was just me.
No way!
Just me, motorbikes, like and a police car. Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, well, so what are you going to give it, guys?
I've given it a two. I gave it a two, because even though I realised, you know, what's the last one we watched called?
Oh, it was The Night something or other, wasn't it?
Only the Night. Yeah. I gave that three because of its curio factor, and I do just feel that like people will be really, really familiar with 28 Days Later.
Mm.
And I do feel that, number one, I said, it's not very well shot. The whole shooting it on video thing has aged it massively. And
I do feel like Walking Dead, this feels really light compared to that, because like...
It's almost like a sketch of an idea, exactly, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of... And I think that's very much it. And so, but what I did enjoy, because I'm a massive Alex Garland super fan, it's nice to see kind of like the early stages. So even though John thinks it's a bit kind of clunky and exposition-y and actory, I like seeing, you can see like Alex Garland starting to stretch his legs with some of the philosophical ideas, because, you know, he's teen philosophy like me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you need to watch, you know, Ex Machina for that. So there were bits that I enjoyed. I'm like, oh, that's an interesting idea. And yeah, that, you know, that still works, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The iconic opening and things like that. Well, I say opening, not the David Schneider bit, the bit around London. That's still worth watching. But still, I was a bit like, about it. I was like, I can take it or leave it. So for me, it's a two.
Brilliant. I gave it two as well. I just can't stand Danny Boyle's weird framing of shots and like frenetic cutting to stuff, which I don't know what's happening. And yeah, it was on such a low grade digital camera. You're like, this is just grey brown shit, you know, basically.
Mm. Yeah, I think the opening sequences set you up for something which then isn't delivered. I think that other things have done it better. So there's a Spanish film called Wreck.
Love it.
Which is really scary. And that is found footage and that's zombies. And that's set in a
apartment building. Yeah. Wreck 2 is good as well.
That's Barcelona, isn't it? Yeah. I think I've seen Wreck 2 as well. So that's very good. This fits in with a British kind of pantheon, which is the Triffids and stuff like that. But I think the first half is good, but then I think the film that James described earlier would have been a lot better than this film, because the bit with the soldiers just derails it, and you're just like, it goes nowhere then. It's a very strange film. I think the decision to, you could reshoot this now on iPhones and make it found footage and stuff.
Yeah.
And it would be a lot more interesting and dynamic. I don't know why they shot it on video, because it's not part of the narrative, is it? It's just like,
it's just cheap.
Well, yeah, I think it was cheap, but it obviously wasn't cheap because it cost £8 million, which is like, when you look at the setup of the bit with the army, with the big house and all the fences and stuff, you can see where they spent the money. But you just think that doesn't add anything to the storyline.
Mm.
If you've got good performers and a solid story, all you need, it doesn't matter. It wouldn't matter if it was shot on that shit quality then, because you'd be engrossed. But you're not really engrossed at any point, are you? After they leave London, it just becomes like quite by numbers.
I can remember it being great at the cinema. I really loved it at the cinema.
I think on a big screen, it would probably... But I think watching it on a tiny little...
And also, I think zombie films are old old hat back then. Whereas this, like you said, this rekindled like the whole zombie genre, and we just see so much of that. If you want to watch a zombie film, watch One Cut of the Dead. It's really, really good. A Korean film.
I won't be watching that.
You got to watch it. No, because first 10 minutes, you think this is absolute shit. Why is anyone recommending this? But then the shitness of it is part of the film. And it's really,
we were going to watch something called Train to Busan.
Yes.
And then, because I saw a thing saying it was on Netflix, and then it wasn't on Netflix. So we haven't watched that. But I think it's difficult because for the start of it, it's like a 2. But for the last third, it's like a -14.
Give it a 1 then.
I think the last third is some of the worst dross that we've watched for this podcast.
Are you saying this is worse than Hellraiser, John?
Yes.
Wow.
I think the bits where they're in the dresses and there's someone, I can basically see, because I've worked on a TV production, and I think anyone that's worked on a TV production, you can just see the guy outside who's flashing the fucking light to make it look like lightning.
And it
just looks so shit. It looks like a really, it looks like an A-level video for like your mate's band. The first two thirds is a 2. The last third is -14.
So what should I give it then? As an overall?
-12.
Ugh. Fucking hell.
-12.
Is that your lowest scoring thing? Yeah, you gave that less than the Rats. You gave the Rats a -10.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Right,
100%. Okay. I probably enjoyed the Rats more than this by the end of it because...
American Werewolf -8.
And you gave
Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires -9.
That's got Peter Cushing in it, though.
Yeah, there we go. Okay.
So, yeah, this is -12. To be honest, I think something like Dawn of the Dead does everything this film does, but much better.
Yeah.
And that's a comedy.
Yeah.
Because it sets up the scenes which are tragic and sad in this comedic way.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, I mean, that also goes a bit, I think the scene at the end in the pub is a bit shit.
Mm.
But I think that film is probably more enjoyable than this film.
Mm. I'd like to watch 28 weeks later now because I can only remember the Robert Carlyle running across the field, but I can't remember anything else about it.
All I remember with Shaun of the Dead is they make a joke about the Second Coming, Stone Roses, which is the far superior second album. And I just thought, wow, any film that makes a joke about the Stone Roses Second Coming, I know where they're coming from because that is a superb album. Superb album.
Let's leave it there, shall we? Next time,
Cleves.
We're doing a double bill of Nigel Neal's Beasts. We're going to revisit Beasts. Okay. Yeah. So we need to pick which two episodes we're going to watch. So these are the ones that we've got to pick between.
Not the one with the fucking...
I want to do the dolphin one.
Flipper. No, we're not having Flipper.
So, okay, we're going to pick between Special Offer, Misfit Teenage Checkout Operator, has an unrelated crush on a supermarket manager. Yeah. At the same shop, cuddly cartoon mascot seems to have come alive and caused a havoc. That's got Pauline Quirk in it.
It's terrible.
During Barty's party, a suburban couple are held under siege by a pack of frighteningly intelligent rats.
That's quite sinister.
We've got to watch that.
You never see the rats, though. You
Buddy Boy, when a nightclub owner buys a derelict dolphinarium, he and a young woman seem to be haunted by the ghost of Buddy Boy, the star attraction. I want to watch that one. What Big Eyes, an RSPCA officer is horrified when he discovers a pet shop owner has been conducting experiments on a wolf searching for proof of lycanthropy. Yeah. The dummy, a washed up actor, has a nervous breakdown, believes he is really the movie monster that he's been hired to play.
Do you know what? I've watched all of those and I can't remember half of them. Give me the options again.
So it's Special Offer, it's Pauline Quirk and the Poltergeist.
Really? Not that one.
During Barty's party, the rats one. Yeah, Buddy Boy, like the dolphin one. What Big Eyes, RSPCA officer.
Who's in the RSPCA one?
I'm not sure.
Jesus.
One of them's got Clive Swift in.
We'll go for the rats one and we'll go for whatever Clive Swift
Okay, I think closer to the dummy one, the washed up actor, or okay. the Oscar
friend,
one.
Friend of the show,
the
Clive
show
Swift.
Clive Swift.
Okay. Okay. Nice until next everyone. Time. Happy day, everyone.
Thanks for listening, as always.
Love, light, and peace.
You have been listening to the General Witchfinders. Support the show and continue the conversation at patreon.com/generalwitchfinders. Subscribe and spread the word at generalwitchfinders.com. Farewell, and don't have nightmares.
Hi, it's Ross from the General Witchfinders. Did you know that I also do another podcast with my friend David?
Hello. No, my headphones are falling off. You're not taking this seriously, Ross.
David and I do our own supernatural research and investigations in our home county of Dorset. So, if you think that's up your street, why don't you give it a listen? It's Dark Darset, D-A-R-Z-E-T. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's not magic.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.